We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Yemen. A young Nigerian man now stands accused of attempting to bring down a Detroit-bound airliner on Christmas Day, and a branch of al-Qaeda based in Yemen has claimed responsibility. This morning, in this hour, we'll try to explore the politics of Yemen, talk a little bit about why this country, which is the poorest in the Middle East, has become a base of operations for militants. And our guest for the program is Gregory Johnson. He's a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen. Currently, he is a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He's written for a variety of publications on Yemen, including Foreign Policy, The American Interest, The Independent, and The Boston Globe. He's also done advising and consulting for a variety of organizations on issues related to Yemen. In 2009, he was a member of USAID's Conflict Assessment Team for Yemen. He's also appeared on CNN, the BBC, NPR, and Al Jazeera English talking about Yemen. And he's often quoted in media outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others. He's joining us this morning remotely. He's not here in the studio, but we're glad we have a high-quality connection there. So it sounds like he's here. Glad to have him talking with us. And, of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. Now, you can call. That number is 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana people. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that. And then we also have email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Any way you do it, it really will help us if you keep your comments brief. That way, we can get in as many different people as possible. Mr. Johnson, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We appreciate it. I think maybe it might be a good idea for us to start with a little geography lesson. I think probably until recently, unless people spend a lot of time talking about this region, they probably hadn't thought or known very much about Yemen. What are the basics that people should know just to start us off?
Well, I think one of the more important things when thinking about Yemen is to realize that it's an incredibly geographically diverse country. That is, you have mountains up in the north. On the western coast, you sort of have this almost East African scrub brush. You have deserts. It's a country that is incredibly difficult to get around, particularly up in the north where it's – a lot of, I think, different commentators have compared it to Afghanistan, and certainly there are segments that would remind us of that. Just geographically speaking, it's right almost dangling off the tip of the Arabian Peninsula. It's just south of Saudi Arabia, across the Gulf of Aden from Somalia. So a very, at least from a strategic perspective, an important point on the globe.
Mm-hmm. People in Washington now are starting to talk about Yemen as being second only to Pakistan and Afghanistan as a concern for terrorism. Now, it's in the news now because of the events just a couple of weeks ago. The administration, I think, has indeed been watching Yemen. What about this now, this elevating it to that point, that is saying next to Pakistan and Afghanistan, that's a place, maybe the number three place that we'd be concerned about. Do you think that that is accurate and appropriate?
Well, I think certainly over the past couple of years, the U.S. administrations, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, have started to pay much more attention to Yemen. But U.S. interest and U.S. attention to Yemen has really waxed and waned since September 11th. So what we're dealing with at the moment in Yemen is really the second incarnation of al-Qaeda. So there was this initial group, and initially – immediately after September 11th, the U.S. And Yemeni governments cooperated quite closely from really about September 2001 all the way up until November 2003. And really by November 2003, it looked as though the U.S. and Yemeni governments had defeated al-Qaeda in Yemen. And at that point, U.S. attention sort of went elsewhere. There was the war in Iraq, of course, and a number of other issues were really drawing off U.S. attention, while the Yemeni government shifted its focus towards a war in the north. And so when you had a prison break in February of 2006, this allowed the al-Qaeda suspects who sort of tunneled out of this political security prison into a neighboring mosque where they then said the morning prayers and walked out the front door to freedom. This gave them really a great deal of space in which they could operate. So they were able to rebuild, reorganize, and really resurrect al-Qaeda in Yemen up from the ashes. Mm. And since that point, since 2006, 2007, the organization has only grown stronger. It's shown that it's incredibly ambitious. And it was only really after the attack on the U.S. Embassy in September 2008 that the U.S. started to once again refocus on al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Maybe we could talk just for a moment about the relationship between the government of Yemen and the United States. The president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, backed Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War, and that certainly soured relations with the United States, with Saudi Arabia as well. And that in the time since, there has of necessity been a rebuilding, had to be a rebuilding of the relationship. What is the current state of relations between the government of Yemen and the government of the United States?
Well, I would characterize it as one of mistrust and distrust. That is, the U.S., the Obama administration is a new administration, and so it's attempting to construct its own policy with President Saleh. But President Saleh has been in power for more than 30 years, and he has a very long memory of how different U.S. administrations have interacted with his government. And I think you're exactly right to point out some of the early history, particularly in the 1990s. Yemen was on the U.N. Security Council, and it did abstain and vote no from a number of resolutions that would have threatened Saddam Hussein with force, that condemned his invasion into Kuwait. And Yemen paid a very high price for that, not only with the U.S., which cut off aid, but also with Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And probably the most important thing to remember here is that Saudi Arabia, in response to Yemen's no vote on the U.N. Security Council, expelled anywhere from about 850,000 to a million Yemeni migrant workers. And this really damaged the Yemen economy. At the time, the Yemeni rial was about 12 to 1 against the U.S. dollar. And now on my most recent trip to Yemen in July and August of 2009, it has fallen all the way to 200 to 1 against the dollar. So it's really been quite a significant problem.
The United States recently has announced that it would be increasing aid to Yemen, both military and non-military. And it would make the point again that Yemen is a very poor country. We are now going to be providing something like, I think, $121 million in non-military aid over the next 3 years. And that's a very big increase over the past levels. How significant for Yemen is this infusion of U.S. aid?
Well, I think it's very significant, but one of the things that I think the U.S. needs to remember when it's operating in Yemen is that the U.S. isn't the most important country within Yemen. Saudi Arabia is by far a much more important actor than the U.S. is, and the U.S. tends to view its own influence and its own leverage within Yemen as being more inflated than it actually is. And so, like I mentioned earlier, there is this sort of waxing and waning of U.S. interest, and the Yemenis themselves believe that the U.S. is only really interested and only really focused and only really putting money into the country when al-Qaeda is a threat. And so when I was, again, there in July and August of this year, I spoke to a number of different Yemenis, from people like the foreign minister, members of parliament, journalists, tribesmen, and so on. And really, to a man, they all said the same thing, and that is that they were concerned that if the al-Qaeda threat were to go away, U.S. aid and U.S. interest in Yemen would also go away.
Mm-hmm. Our guest, maybe I should introduce again, our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Gregory Johnson. He's a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen. Right now, he's working on a PhD in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, and he has written on Yemen for a variety of publications, including Foreign Policy, The Independent, The Boston Globe. He's also done a lot of interviewing. He's appeared on CNN, BBC, NPR, talking about Yemen, often quoted in stories about Yemen. And he's been good enough to spend some time with us talking about the country this morning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go back again here. I know, I realize we're kind of jumping around a little bit. Talk a little bit about what's happened in Yemen, say, over the last 20 years or so. Going back to 1990, at the point where what we had two countries, then they became one country. At that point, the current president came into office, and he's been there ever since. And there still continues to be tension between the government and people in the north, where there has been civil war, and people in the south, where there is a secessionist movement. I realize that's a lot, but maybe you can make that picture a little bit more clear.
Sure. I think a brief sort of thumbnail sketch would do us all some good. And so I think when talking about Yemen, we'll go back to the 1960s just briefly, and this is when there are two separate but simultaneous civil wars, one in the north, which was really a fight between royalists and republicans. This was at times a proxy conflict between Egypt and Saudi Arabia, where a republican regime was overthrowing this thousand-year-old Zaydi imamate, this sort of religious political office. And so this went from 1962 to 1970. In the south, there was as I mentioned, a separate civil war. This was almost a colonial war where the Brits had occupied Aden as a crown colony and had much of the rest of the south as sort of a protectorate. And they were eventually expelled in about the 1967. And so from there, you had two different trajectories. The South Yemen, as it was known colloquially, became almost a Marxist republic, if you will. It was heavily dependent upon aid from the Soviet Union, while in the north you had much more of a tribal patronage-based government. In the north, President Ali Abdullah Saleh came to power in 1978. He came to power right on the heels of his two immediate predecessors being assassinated in rather gruesome circumstances. So politics in Yemen was, throughout the 1970s, a very rough and tumble game, which President Saleh was able to survive and really flourish. In 1990, as it looked like the Soviet Union was really going to be unable, of course, to continue to provide aid to the South began looking about, and unity, which had really been part of both countries' rhetoric for a number of years, but neither had really taken any steps to sort of advance along this road to meet their goals of unification, became almost an overnight story. That is, President Saleh went south to Aden, met with the president there, Ali Salam al-Bidh, and the two came to an agreement where they would put this idea of unification up for referendum, which they did in 1990. It never worked out that well. The military units weren't integrated. There was a number of problems going back and forth between the North and particularly President Saleh and some other individuals affiliated with tribes using former fighters from Afghanistan as almost a wedge against the Socialist Party in the South. And so 4 years after unification, there was a civil war and the South tried to secede. The North put this down. And since then, there have been a number of separate problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, how unstable a place is this? Or is that something that we should be worried about?
Well, I think stability is certainly a concern, but this is one of the things that you often hear people who don't have a great deal of experience in Yemen, haven't traveled around the country, sort of speaking about it as a lawless place, this wild west where anything can happen, and that's not really true. It's not even true to sort of speak about some of the areas where the government doesn't have a great deal of power or influence as being these undergoverned or ungoverned spaces. These spaces are governed. They're just not necessarily governed by the central government. There's a tribal order that exists, particularly in the north, which is very important and which the government utilizes at different times. But it's something where if you think of tribes almost as an institution, it's not something that's very familiar to us in the West. And so when journalists go and report, they just talk about it. The government doesn't have control. Therefore, it must be an uncontrolled space. And that's really not the case.
Hmm. Well, I take your point that there seems to be a lot written about Yemen as being a violent place with this warrior tradition. I think that I read somewhere that it was estimated that in a country of 20 million people that there are at least 20 million guns. So that's, you know, one gun per person, which would give you the impression that it is a wild and dangerous and lawless place. So it's really not like that.
There are a number of people do carry guns. Carrying guns is a big part of the tradition, as are these sort of ceremonial daggers that people have. Derek Miller, an individual, a researcher in Europe, wrote, I think, a very good report on Yemen for the Small Arms Survey a number of years, and he estimated the number of guns as being much less than sort of that 60 million number that often gets put out in the press. But I think it's important to remember that while a number of people are heavily armed, And certainly the government does not have a monopoly on violence or on the use of force or power within the country, that there are also rules that aren't readily apparent to outsiders, sort of dictating how and when one can discharge a firearm or putting almost, if you will, sort of parameters on violence within the country. And one of the things that's heavily prized within Yemen is sort of this idea that you can get off this escalating ramp of violence, if you will. There are numerous off-ramps for dialogue and negotiation that tribes and the government constantly and continually avail themselves of in Yemen.
How long has al-Qaeda been in Yemen, and how strong an organization are they now?
Well, this is, I think, one of the difficulties when talking about al-Qaeda is we tend to say al-Qaeda, and then we all sort of think we know what it is that we mean. But al-Qaeda has changed so much in Yemen. Its roots go back into the early 1990s. An individual named Tariq al-Fadli, who's from the south, he's from this governorate of Abyan, actually. He grew up in Saudi Arabia, eventually went to Afghanistan in the 1980s, fought with Osama bin Laden there, was a very close lieutenant, a very close person to bin Laden in the fighting. He went back after unification in the 1990s and sort of used a number of former Arab Afghans that he'd had from the campaign in Afghanistan against the socialists. And there was some initial talk of al-Qaeda being there during the early part of the 1990s. Certainly the president used a number of former fighters from Afghanistan against the South in the Civil War. And then really after that, in 1995, 96, 97, 98, al-Qaeda looked at Yemen as a place of refuge and rest, if you will. They seized upon this apocryphal hadith or saying of the Prophet Muhammad that said, when disorder threatens, seek refuge in Yemen. And so this is something that you saw a number of individuals sort of referencing and referring to. And at this time in the mid to late 1990s, the Yemeni government had, I think, what could best be described as a tacit non-aggression pact with al-Qaeda figures there. That is, they wouldn't go after them as long as al-Qaeda didn't really go after and target the government. They would sort of leave each other alone. That changed, of course, with the USS Cole, and then particularly after September 11th, when President Saleh believed that his government was going to be next on a hit list after Afghanistan. And so he took a number of steps to make sure that President Bush knew that Yemen was going to support the U.S. in the war on terror. The organization that we're dealing with now, this al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, is a much different version of al-Qaeda than the earlier organizations that we saw in Yemen.
Mm. And how – I think, again, a question that's often asked is what sort of connections that there are or are there connections? How much direction is there for this now consolidated group, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which, as I understand it, is some kind of a combination of al-Qaeda elements that had been in Yemen and also had been in Saudi Arabia? What sort of connections are there? Is there direction coming from al-Qaeda that is based in Afghanistan and Pakistan, or is now al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula essentially operating as an independent group?
Right, and this is something that I think has befuddled analysts for quite some time. The way I see it is, while certainly the organization pays reverence to Osama bin Laden and other individuals within Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's really a parallel organization as opposed to sort of a wholly owned subsidiary. That is, they have a great deal of autonomy. Nasr al-Waheshi is the emir of this organization. And so I talked about them as sort of breaking out of prison in February of 2006. And since then, I see them as really going through about three distinct stages. In the first stage in 2006, 2007, Nasr al-Waheshi, this emir, as well as Qasem al-Rehmi, one of his top lieutenants, did a very good job of sort of rebuilding and making sure that the organization had a strong infrastructure in Yemen. Then in 2008, they launched this campaign of violence within Yemen. They started it off in January when they released the first issue of their bimonthly journal called Sadr Malahim, which is, translates roughly into The Echo of Battles. And this campaign really culminated in the attack on the U.S. Embassy in September of 2008. Then they move into this third stage, which is where the organization wanted to demonstrate that it was something that could be a danger not only within the country of Yemen, but within the entire region, to almost show that they had regional reach, if you will. And so this is when they had the merger between the Yemeni branches of al-Qaeda and the Saudi branch. This was, of course, headlined by the return to violence of two former Guantanamo Bay detainees on the Saudi side. And so since then, they've been very active and very ambitious. And this Nasr al-Wahashi, an individual I've mentioned a number of times, was actually a personal assistant and a personal aide to Osama bin Laden. He fought with him at Tora Bora. And he's someone, at least as I see him, who's attempted to model this organization, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, along the lines of the template that bin Laden set out in Afghanistan. So he's sort of modeling himself on his former boss and attempting to set up an organization like bin Laden did in Afghanistan.
We're getting close to our midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Geneva, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Good topic conversation. The Middle East has always intrigued me. I studied it when I was in the high school, and I studied part of it in college. And to me, it just seems like there's no organization as far as, you know, like a democracy or something. I know that I've come across several papers and seen this online where that a lot of these criminals are coming, a lot of the terrorists are coming back and forth over borders, and nobody seems to really care about stopping them. So they got free haven. If somebody goes, for instance, and tries to shut them down in Yemen, then they'll go over to Somalia and vice versa. Same thing with Afghanistan and Pakistan. What I'm concerned about as an American, I know the whole entire general population of Middle East seems to hate us. Sooner or later, somebody's going to get a hold of something and going to drop something on us. It's just a matter of time. And it's like the governments that be over there really don't seem to care. I mean, that's just the way I'm perceiving. I don't know if it's true or not. Do they have a handle on, for instance, bin Laden, do they have a handle on where he's at and what he's doing? Are they cooperating with the countries that are looking for him? Or do they just, it's just one of those things where the corruption in the government end of it is running the thing. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's a lot there. You can comment on any of that that you feel you can.
Yeah, there certainly are a number of, I think, very excellent points in the caller's question and comment there. To start with smuggling, certainly that's a problem in Yemen. Yemen does not have great control over its borders. The United States in 2002 helped the Yemeni government set up a coast guard to deal with part of this problem, although that organization is still fairly weak and really overmanned and outmanned by the smugglers. Saudi Arabia has attempted to build a wall along its southern border with Yemen. That has not proved very successful. There's a great deal of smuggling going back and forth. And I think one of the important things to remember is that sort of when these boundaries were drawn on the map, they often bisected or cut through different tribal regions. And so you have tribes that occupy positions on both sides of the border. And that's made it very, very difficult for governments in this region to sort of exercise full control there. On the issue of sort of what's often become known as whack-a-mole, where you hit al-Qaeda in one place and it pops up in another place, I don't really subscribe to this theory. I tend to believe, just from my own experience in following al-Qaeda and Yemeni politics for a number of years now, that the sort of the resurgence of al-Qaeda that we're seeing in Yemen is not the result of say, U.S. successes in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but really it's a result of U.S. and Yemeni failures within the Yemeni context. So this is really a local problem that both governments have really contributed to. So in my mind, the resurgence of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is a story of U.S. and Yemeni failures in Yemen as opposed to U.S. successes elsewhere.
All right. Let's talk with someone else here. We have a couple of other callers in Champaign, starting with line one right here. Hello.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. First is, what role does religion play? The two different groups of the Muslim faith, the Sunnis and the Shias, play in conflict in the area. And then the other thing is just a comment on something you just said, and that's that the borders are set up so they cut through natural sociological or ethnic divisions or tribal divisions. And was that a function of the way things were carved up by the colonial powers and set up when they receded? I think that's true of Iraq, that it was set up to be a state that was ungovernable. So comments.
All right, Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, I think those are, again, two excellent questions. So I'll start with sort of the last one first. I think the caller's absolutely right that in many places these borders were drawn by colonial powers. With the Yemen case in particular, this isn't what happened there. Saudi Arabia back in the 1930s fought a couple of wars against the Imam in Yemen, where they were able to sort of peel off a couple of provinces that they now have in their control. And it wasn't really until 2000 that part of the border was actually demarcated between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. So I think in large parts of the Middle East, the caller's absolutely right. Stuff like what happened in Iraq is reminiscent of what happened elsewhere. But in the Yemen case in particular, it's a slightly different story. As far as the role of religion, one of the things we've spent a lot of time talking about al-Qaeda for obvious reasons, but we haven't really talked about this separate civil war that's going on up in the north. And this is something that a lot of outside commentators see as sort of a Sunni versus Shia conflict, because that's almost how we've been taught to think about these things, particularly given what's happened in Iraq. But in the Yemeni context, again, it's slightly different. So the group, the rebel group up in the north, they are Shia. They're what's known as Zaydi Shia, which is a sect of Shiism. But these Zaydis are really much closer to Sunni Islam than they are to the type of Shiism that we're familiar with in the West, the type of Shiism that's practiced in Iran or in Iraq or elsewhere. And in fact, the president of Yemen himself is a Zaydi. So it's really misleading, I think, to talk about that conflict in Sunni versus Shia terms, or even as sort of a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, as many people do. That's not quite what's happening. This is very much a localized conflict that's having a more regional and international one grafted onto it.
All right. I have another call I want to get right to in just a second, but we are a little bit past our midpoint here, and I would like to introduce again the guest for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in the last 15 or so minutes. Gregory Johnson is our guest. He's a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen, currently a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He's written for a number of publications, written about Yemen for a number of publications, including The Foreign Policy, The American Interest, The Independent, The Boston Globe. He has also advised and consulted for a variety of different organizations on issues relating to Yemen. In 2009, he was member of USAID's Conflict Assessment Team for Yemen. He's appeared on CNN, BBC, NPR, Al Jazeera English talking about Yemen, and has been quoted often in New York Times, Washington Post, other media outlets. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And we now have email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we'll have another Champaign caller. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of seeking a bit of elucidation here. With respect to the Wahhabism, if I'm saying that right, the Saudi Arabian variant or sect of Islam. As I understand, they're supporting the madrasas religious schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. How does that cut in Yemen? And is there some irony with a regime that's essentially propped up by the United States or backed by the United States? On the other hand, accepting that aid from us on one hand, and on the other hand, what exactly does Wahhabism preach with respect to dealing with the West? Can you just talk about that? Thanks.
Well, go ahead.
Yes, I think the sort of the school or sect, if you will, that the caller is referring to is known as Wahhabis or Wahhabism after an individual, Muhammad Abdul al-Wahhab, who really got the organization or the his teachings are what's followed. Of course, within the region, being known as a Wahhabi is a bit of a pejorative. It tends to indicate that the individual is following the teachings of the man, Muhammad Abdul al-Wahhab, as opposed to the teachings of the Quran. So individuals who ascribe to what we would often refer to as Wahhabism often refer to themselves in Arabic, at least, as what is known as Muwahhidun, which means that they are individuals who ascribe to the oneness of God. And that's sort of the basic idea, the main sort of reason for being behind the sect. Certainly, the Wahhabis and Saudi Arabia in particular have been very active in having this sort of proselytizing reach throughout the world, not only throughout the Middle East and throughout the Muslim world, but also into the United States, into Europe. And this has also been a problem in Yemen, and in fact is at really the roots of this civil war that we've talked about up in the north. So throughout the 1980s and 1990s, all these Wahhabis sort of came pouring into Yemen from Saudi Arabia into this northern province known as Saada. And they came into conflict with the Zaydis. So it was this clash almost. I think there's an excellent article in Middle East Report from the late 1990s that talks about a clash of fundamentalists up in the north. And this was these Zaydi purists and these Wahhabi sort of outsiders who were coming into conflict with each other. The Zaydis felt as though their cultural heritage was in danger of being eradicated by what they thought was this two-pronged alliance from the Yemeni government and these Wahhabi proselytizers. And so this is really at the roots of this Houthi conflict, this separate civil war up in the north, is some of the proselytizing that the caller put his finger on.
Just for a moment, I want to talk a little bit about, have you talk a little bit about how people in Yemen feel about the United States. And as I read about this, I read different sorts of things, that maybe there is some anti-Americanism in Yemen, but not what it is, not at the level that you see it in some other countries, which makes it for us, how we conduct ourselves in Yemen, a delicate matter. The president has said that he has no intention, now at least, of sending American troops into Yemen, although he seems to have kind of left the door open there. And clearly, the United States has provided support, both military and non-military, to the government. So how, to the extent that you can answer the question, what can you say about how people in Yemen feel about the United States? And is there a danger that we might, by our actions, make things worse than they might be now?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question. And so I can certainly speak to my experience. And I think Yemenis in general do a very, very good job of differentiating between individual Americans and U.S. policies. And they tend to see U.S. policies as something that they disagree with by and large and something that's against their interest, while at the same time they're incredibly warm, very friendly people who are willing to not only listen but to engage with different Americans. So I'll give you a few anecdotes. I was in Yemen when the pictures of Abu Ghraib came out. I was in Yemen when Saddam Hussein was captured. I was in Yemen when Israel targeted the head of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And in all of those circumstances, Yemenis, of course, were very upset at what was happening, but they were very eager also to hear my own views. On my most recent trip to Yemen, as I mentioned, I spoke with many, many different individuals from very high positions in government to tribesmen who have very little role whatsoever with the government. And to a man, they really talked about how they wish that the U.S. would have a more robust, a more active policy towards Yemen. This is not sort of sending troops there, which I agree, I think that would be catastrophic. But I think one of the problems that the U.S. has had is that by focusing so exclusively on al-Qaeda within Yemen to really the exclusion of every other threat, and by linking all of its aid to this single issue, the U.S. has almost ensured, it's almost induced the exact type of results that it's hoping to avoid. That is, you can't just deal with al-Qaeda in isolation from all the other threats going on within Yemen. And Yemenis realize this. Al-Qaeda greatly benefits from the fact that the Yemeni government is sort of overburdened at the moment from the war up in the north, from the increasingly violent calls for secession in the south. And so people in Yemen see this and they realize this, and they want more U.S. action there in terms that are outside sort of the military scope, if you will.
All right. Let's talk with another caller, Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes. Thank you, David. I'm going to propose that your guest give us, the listening public and the reading public, a scholarly overview of what he's been talking about this morning, and others who both call this program and who are on the program. Scholarship seems to be irrelevant these days, and all we hear about in venues such as the one this morning are symptoms. I said this before, and I want to reiterate that the news, the broadcast TV, everything that informs the public, those who bother to even think about it, are showered with symptoms of a primary ailment that is reducing by the day the intellect, the outlook, the general condition of a greater public around the world. And focused on symptoms never gets to a cure. I mean, keep pronouncing the symptoms of what a basal disease is, which in my opinion is male aggression, and which has been eating humanity alive for 7,000 years. And if you could give us a scholarly overview or what your opinion is of then, why we keep repeating over and over, and now more intense in the last 50 years. Thanks.
All right. Well, I don't know that you can comment on all of human history, whether you would just like to restrict yourself to talking about Yemen and about this region and about U.S. policy in the region. I think it's certainly a fair question, as the caller says, to ask, going beyond just describing what's going on, to ask the question, what do you think that the policy should be? You know, so if the president asked you, what should I be doing about Yemen, what would you say?
Right, and I think that's a very, very important question. And this is something that a lot of very intelligent, very smart people have disagreed over in the past several years. The way I see it in Yemen is that there really are no easy or obvious solutions. There are, I think, some ways that the U.S. can be a force for good there. And I think this goes along with the meeting that Prime Minister Gordon Brown of the U.K. has called for January 28th in London. And so I've spoken with a number of people who are going to be involved with the meeting. And the things that they're coming back and talking about are things that I largely agree on. And this is that there needs to be a coordinated approach to Yemen and to its really multitude of problems. That is that the U.S., the U.K., its European allies, as well as GCC countries, these are countries in the Gulf Cooperation Council, particularly Saudi Arabia, have to be involved in dealing with Yemen as we go forward. And so what that strategy is going to look like is going to evolve, and it's going to depend a great deal upon the local context. So what's going to work in a governorate like Saada up in the north is going to be much different than, say, what has to be done in a place like Shebwa in the south. And Shebwa is where the raids were carried out on Christmas Eve, if you'll remember, U.S. and Yemeni operation to target al-Qaeda fighters there. And so my argument would be really that it has to be a localized, it has to be a nuanced, and it has to be a multifaceted strategy. So we know, for instance, that the U.S. can do a great deal along with its European allies, its regional allies, in sort of providing employment opportunities, helping with poverty in Yemen, which we know from some of the work that I've done as well as other scholars, is a major driving factor for individuals joining al-Qaeda there. One of the things that the U.S. can help do is sort of pressure Saudi Arabia and some of the other countries in the region to open up once again their labor markets to Yemenis. This would go a long way towards solving many of the problems that we have and do a great deal to eradicate some of the poverty that we've seen. Just for listeners who are interested, I would mention a few scholars who I think their work is generally well respected. A very popular book is by Tim McIntosh Smith, Travels in Dictionary Land. Tim studied at Oxford, went to Yemen in 1982, has lived there ever since. Bernard Haeckel at Princeton University has done some excellent work on Yemen. Paul Dresch at Oxford University is another great scholar whose works are, I think, very illuminating. And Stephen Caden at Harvard University has also done some really amazing anthropological works on Yemen.
Just to pick up on a few of these points and talk about them a little bit more, to talk about things going beyond political instability, talk about some of the economic problems the country is having. As you noted, unemployment in Yemen is very high. And most of the population of the country is young. They're mostly under 30. And that segment of the population is really expected to double significantly in the decades ahead. And I think that a lot of people argue there is simply no way that all of those people will be able to find employment within Yemen. They're going to have to leave the country to look for work. And it would be a natural, because the neighbor is Saudi Arabia, that would be one place that they might go. How do other countries in the region feel about that, about welcoming guest workers, people from outside of their own countries? Is that a big issue?
It certainly is a big issue. I think this goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the program in 1990, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait really not only expelling the guest workers in the case of Saudi Arabia, but cutting off aid in the case of Kuwait. This is something that is certainly a very controversial issue within these countries. And it's something that most of the countries within the region, that is the six GCC countries, the countries from the Gulf Cooperation Council, are very frightened of Yemen. Their view, and I tend to share this view, is that in the future, Yemen is not going to implode. That is, all the problems that Yemen has will stay within the borders of what we now know as Yemen, but rather that Yemen is going to explode, and its problems of today are going to become Saudi Arabia's problems of tomorrow, Kuwait's problems of tomorrow, and so forth. And so they're really sort of struggling to figure out what it is that they can do with this. There is a concern from Saudi Arabia that, you know, Yemen is a place they don't understand very well, despite being right next door to it. And if they sort of open up this labor market, then they're worried about individual Yemenis coming back over, where al-Qaeda could sort of mix in with this group and then carry out attacks within the kingdom. We know that this summer, al-Qaeda, in a really what was a very ingenious attack, attempted to assassinate Saudi Arabia's counterterrorism chief, the deputy minister for the interior, Mohammed bin Nayef. And so Saudi Arabia is quite concerned about Yemen.
We have about 6-7 minutes left, just very quickly to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Gregory Johnson. He's a scholar who's been following Yemen, studying Yemen for a long time. He's a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen. He's currently a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, has written for a number of publications on Yemen, has also done a lot of interviews. CNN, BBC, NPR have been often quoted in stories about Yemen, and that's what we're talking about. Questions are certainly welcome. Someone wants to dial up real quick, we can get him in the time that remains, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something else I think is really striking about Yemen, and it's a way in which perhaps they're out ahead of other countries in the region in terms of problems that they have to face, like everybody else, their economies are built on oil, but apparently in Yemen, it's starting to run out. And even more serious, they're running out of water. In fact, as I read, Yemen might be the first modern capital to actually run out of water. How does one deal with a situation like that?
Well, this is, again, a problem. And I know this has been sort of a depressing conversation. And it's really easy, I think, to, when you think about Yemen, to really become overwhelmed by the totality of the crises that the country faces. So we've talked about sort of these security threats, the Al-Qaeda threat, the civil war up in the north, the calls for secession from the south. And this is really, at least for me, sort of a middle layer, if you will, of conflicts and crises within the country. Above this, you have this elite rivalry where individuals within the president's family are struggling for power, looking to position themselves to take up power after the president leaves, which is causing a great deal of animosity and rivalry within the military and intelligence structure. And then at the bottom, you have these foundational challenges, which I think you put your finger on. So yes, the government is heavily dependent upon oil. It relies on oil for about 75% of its budget, which is a huge amount. Yes, the country is about to run out of water. Many people in the country are dependent upon subsistence agriculture for their livelihood. And so what happens when water runs out is a question that's, I think, really bedeviling many analysts and policymakers. Unemployment, as we've talked about, is very high. The birth rate is incredibly high. Literacy rates are, of course, very, very low. So there's really a laundry list here. And what the Yemeni government does, it doesn't really seem to have a strategy to deal with many of these. It's Sarah Phillips, an Australian academic whose work on Yemen and is also well-respected, came up with this phrase that sort of talks about the Yemeni government as being a government of crisis management. That is, they bounce from challenge to challenge and really have no sort of overarching theory or strategy to deal with everything that's going on in the country.
I'm going back to United States and U.S. policy, but the one thing I didn't want to make sure that I ask you, there apparently are something like 90 or more than 90 Yemenis being held at Guantanamo Bay, and that there was this plan, at least before Christmas, there was this plan that something like 40, 50 of them would be released and allowed to return home. Now, because of what's happened since Christmas, some people have said, well, maybe that's not such a good idea. Do you think that that those Yemenis that are being held, that the United States needs to continue to hold them?
Well, this is a really difficult issue for the Obama administration. Certainly, the way in which many of these Yemenis were captured, that is, they were caught up in this dragnet in Afghanistan and Pakistan right after September 11th when the U.S. was sort of paying its Pakistani allies for whatever Arabs, has brought in a lot of innocent and guilty individuals. So separating the innocent out from the guilty has proven to be something that, at least for U.S. officials, has really been difficult to do. The Yemenis in Guantanamo aren't any more dangerous than the Saudis. But the Saudis have been released back to Saudi Arabia largely because the U.S. trusts the Saudi government and the U.S. does not trust the Yemeni government. Of course, we now know that a number of Saudis have returned to Al-Qaeda. And in fact, there have been about 21 Yemenis released from Guantanamo since they started doing releases up till this latest group. And one of those individuals has returned to Al-Qaeda. He was actually killed in a raid on December 17th. We also know that a number of individuals within Guantanamo have links to members who are currently in Guantanamo who are currently in Al-Qaeda. So, for instance, the military commander, Qasem al-Raimi, one of his younger brothers is in Guantanamo, a man that the U.S. killed in Somalia in June of 2007. He has two younger brothers in Guantanamo. So these family links we know are often very, very important within the jihadi world. Jihad is almost a family business, if you will. But at the same time, the U.S. is concerned about releasing these individuals. Al-Qaeda within the Arabian Peninsula is using the existence of Guantanamo as sort of a very strong propaganda and rhetorical point that it uses to gain recruits throughout Yemen and throughout the Arabian Peninsula. So it's a very difficult situation for the Obama administration to sort of balance what it is, these risks of letting them go against the risks of keeping them incarcerated.
And I suppose just, again, to flip back over to Yemen, the government of Yemen is in a difficult position. They may feel some threat from al-Qaeda there, although in the past, as you say, there has been this agreement between al-Qaeda and the government of Yemen that essentially the government has said, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. And the government also, there has been this past history of using jihadis to fight in the south. So here, though, they're facing, they may have some real internal security concerns related to al-Qaeda. They're facing pressure from the United States to do something about al-Qaeda in Yemen. How does the government of Yemen walk that line?
Well, this is, I think, one of the really fundamental difficulties of dealing with both the Yemeni government and attempting to solve the problem of al-Qaeda there, is that the view from Washington is so much different from the view from Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. So what is seen in Washington is all these individuals who sort of sound like al-Qaeda, think like al-Qaeda, act like al-Qaeda. They're all al-Qaeda. But when you get to Yemen, you see there are so many different nuances and shades of gray. So for the Yemeni government, this isn't an enemy that's far away. These are their cousins. These are their brothers. These are members of different tribes. So you don't just have individuals who are al-Qaeda members. You have al-Qaeda members who have many different hats, if you will. So they can utilize their tribal identity. They can utilize their identity as a member of this particular group. And so when the Yemeni government goes after them, they don't just fight al-Qaeda. They get sucked into this world where they become involved in tribal conflicts, and it's a very murky and multifaceted world.
Hmm. Well, does that, though, suggest that it is possible for the government of Yemen and maybe for the government of the United States to come to some kind of accommodation with these al-Qaeda elements in Yemen, or is that too much to expect?
Well, I mean, this is, I think, another one of the difficulties is I tend to think of Islamists in Yemen, or people that we would often say is al-Qaeda, as being along the spectrum, if you will. And al-Qaeda only occupies one particular point, but there are many, many different Islamists. So the trick is, who do you want to be your enemy? If you expand the net out so far, and if you expand the definition of who is al-Qaeda to be so broad, then you end up fighting way too many individuals for you ever to be successful in any sort of a war against them. So you really want to narrow it and undermine al-Qaeda and delegitimize the organization to the point that when you do carry out military strikes or when you do arrest these individuals, it's seen as a good thing. Yeah. But that groundwork, that sort of proper field work, hasn't yet been done. And so any of these military strikes or going after these individuals tends to be counterproductive because al-Qaeda can just replace the individuals who are killed with others because al-Qaeda is still seen as sort of pious individuals defending their faith within Yemen.
Gregory Johnson, our guest, former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen, currently a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, has written for many publications on Yemen, also has been widely interviewed about Yemen. Thanks very much, Mr. Johnson, for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.